All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Yes, and welcome to another program of Veterans Radio. I'm Bob Gould, your host today. And I'm glad to see that the orchestra, the band, we must have given those guys a raise, right? Yeah, they're all nodding there. And with me in the control room, well, he can't say anything right now, but is Derek and Nina. Nina's our screener and associate and whatever. Okay, so we're about ready to get started here. We're going to be talking about Korea. That's right, Korea. Hey, man, where's that? Well, it's in Southeast Asia. I think you could say that. Yeah, Southeast Asia, Korea. We've had many programs on Korea, and we're very fortunate that we have the folks available that can give us this information. It is a hotbed, absolutely. But before we do that, okay, coming up at the end of the summer and the beginning of fall, there's going to be, I'm sure, all around you, all around the world. By the way, folks, we do broadcast all around the world, right here from our main flagship station, WAAM Talk Radio 1600 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So we're here right now. But there are things all over the country. So take a look in the newspapers. Right, you're going to be fine. There's going to be a lot of fundraisers from the VFWs, the American Legions of the World, the Vietnam Vets, the War Dogs, et cetera, et cetera. They're all going to be, all of them, all around. So you're going to want to be looking and attend these things, folks. Sure, they're a lot of fun. Bring the whole family, moms, dads, kids, everything. And there is one coming up, Sunday, September 11th. Ooh, 9/11. Oh, how about that, folks? And we're going to be broadcasting that date. We should probably do something on the World Trade, New York, the whole thing that day. So Sunday, September 11th, starting at noon, the VFW Post 423 on Wagner Road in Ann Arbor is going to be a pork dinner. A lot of piggies, man. Them piggies are really good, yeah. And there is going to be activities, live music entertainment, face painting, Huey helicopter, Dale would like that. Yep, my pilot partner, and military vehicles, bucket drawings for many wonderful items, military merchandise sales. Tickets are $10 and $5 for kids. Anybody under 6 is free. But that's going to be at the VFW Post 423 Wagner Road, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Sunday, September 11th, 9/11. 9/11/16, right? How many years ago has that been? Okay. Second on my little item here in the top is we get a lot of requests for DD-214. Folks, you've got to have your DD-214 everywhere. You should have it. In fact, you should have multiple copies. Wherever you go to get your health care, to get services at the VA, they're going to ask you that, well, it's somewhere in my drawer. Don't worry about that. Go get it now. Put it somewhere where you can show the wife and anybody else that's going to be responsible for you to wear that DD-214. How do you get one? Oh, man, I can't find mine. Well, go to archives.gov. Isn't that easy? Archives.gov. I bet you can get a whole bunch of stuff there. www.archives.gov. Follow the prompts. If you are requesting for your mom, dad, brother, etc., and you are a relative, there will be a little space for that. Do not send anything other than the paperwork that they don't send a death certificate, don't send marriage certificates, don't even send copies of them. Follow the prompts. Got it? Go to www.archives.gov and be patient. It takes about 3 months before they even, they're swamped, right? Right. I got mine. It was really cool. And something else, too, folks, if you get a chance, once you get your DD-214, sign up. Sign up over at your local VA hospital. Even if you're not going to get your services there, you're already signed up. So if you do need it, they don't have to go looking all this paperwork and information up. So stay current, stay focused, stay healthy, and we'll be right back right after this message. Hit it, Chauncey. And we're back on Veterans Radio. Bob Gould right here. Dale Thronberry is on vacation. That's cool. He deserves it. He's been doing quite a bit of work. Today, we're going to be talking again about career. There's a lot going on. We have a lot to cover. And with me, frequent guest on Veterans Radio, you might know him more for his work on our program's Grit. By the way, we're getting a lot of feedback on that. So people really like that, how we rank the commanders, et cetera. In fact, one of them, MacArthur, I had to think about that. Remember his pipe? I don't remember his name. And we'll be talking about him today. But I want to welcome as our guest, historian. He's the director of the Army's Operational Contract Support Course at Fort Lee, Virginia. He's author of Cold Day in Hell, American POWs in Korea. Guess what, folks? We're going to be talking about him. He's a retired Army lieutenant colonel who flew Chinooks. Man, if you've ever heard one of those things take off, you know what I'm talking about. I was at a place over here at Eastern Michigan University, and they had one of those, and then it came time to leave. And I'm going to say that thing sucked when it got both those rotors going. That sucked everything, every dog, cat, mouse, tree, limb, anything loose within 200 yards was pulled in. Wow, what a machine. So let's put them together, make a big welcome to Bill Latham. Bill, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Bob, thanks very much for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
Did I get that right about sucking everything underneath those?
That's about it. It's basically a tropical storm flying through the sky.
Yeah, man. And what would you say, long are those rotors? What would be the diameter of a...
Oh, Bob, I didn't know there was going to be a quiz.
No, no. I'm just curious.
80 to 90 feet. It's a pretty big helicopter. We want a whole football field if we're going to land in your neighborhood.
Yeah, and they did. And but anyway, enough of that, because did they have Chinooks in Korea?
No Chinooks in Korea. We first started using Chinooks in Vietnam, and we used them a lot in Desert Storm, and we've used them a lot in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're a very capable aircraft. They can haul a lot of people, and they can get people out of trouble.
Well, you know, that kind of puts us, again, into Korea, 1950 to 53. That was a transition time when... What were the material handling back then? Were we talking about the C-119s and what else? I mean, helicopters were just coming on. Can you just give us a quick moment or two on that?
Sure. Korea was the first war that saw widespread use of helicopters, primarily for medical evacuation. That portion of the MASH TV show is fairly accurate. One of the limitations, of course, was that early helicopters had very limited power, and so as you see in the TV show and in the movie, two casualties was the most they could carry at any one time, but still the advent of helicopters in Korea saved a lot of lives of wounded soldiers and Marines, and that expanded dramatically in Vietnam, where we upgraded to the Huey helicopter, which is a much more powerful vehicle for medical evacuation, and today the Army uses Blackhawks, which are extremely capable, and not only can we evacuate wounded soldiers and Marines, but we can also treat them en route, which saves a lot of lives.
Sikorsky must be smiling, eh?
Sikorsky built a great helicopter. It really is kind of the Ferrari of the skies.
Well, speaking of...
It's powerful, and it can take... It can take quite a beating.
It's changed everything, folks. Right. And the concept was even around, Leonardo. Yeah, he had the concept of a helicopter, if you all look at some of his drawings. And I don't think he ever tried it, though, you know, so that's all right. But getting back to Korea, like so often, has been in the backwater of politics. It's there. And it's in Southeast Asia. And if we look at other countries that have been sort of, quote, in the middle, unquote, We look at Belgium, France, between France and Germany, and we look at Iran between Afghanistan and Pakistan. There's somebody in the middle. Now we got Korea. Korea, I believe, is between China and the West, which includes Japan. Now, here's the starting. By the way, folks, we're going to be going very quickly into POWs, but right now I just want to touch on this. Goodness, Korea just seems to stay up there. Why do you think that is, Colonel Latham?
Korea's in a dangerous corner of the world, Bob. You've got the former Soviet Union right there on the border with North Korea. North Korea shares an extended border with China, and then Japan is only a few dozen miles away across the China Sea, and then both North and South Korea have hundreds of thousands of soldiers under arms. It's a dangerous spot, and it's also an area of great strategic interest, not only for the United States, but for many other of our allies. So Korea is just in a dangerous spot, and it always has been. There's an old saying in Korea that the Korean Peninsula is a shrimp caught between two whales. That's a reference to the Japanese and Chinese empires dating back hundreds of years, and both Chinese and Japanese emperors have invaded China, and at various times the Koreans have lived under Chinese and under Japanese rule.
So what we've got right now is, and by the way, we still have Kim Jong-un. Am I get that right? Kim Jong-un?
Good to me.
Yes, good. Kim Jong-un. We'll call him Mr. Woon. There you go. And he is his biggest supporter, North Korea. Is that Russia or China?
Well, China's friendly. Russia's probably a little bit more supportive. China has been supportive in the past few years, and there are a few non-aligned countries that have friendly relations with North Korea. I honestly can't think of them off the top of my head, but no superpowers, certainly. But North Korea's economy has been in a shambles for the last 25 years because when the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union collapsed, they stopped receiving financial support from the Soviet Union and from the Eastern Bloc nations. And so that was a huge blow to the North Korean economy, and they've really been in a downward spiral ever since. And they have partially alienated their Chinese neighbors to the north, with whom they've always had a very uneasy relationship, even though both countries are communist.
And they share a border.
And they share a long border. And it's that shared border that is so critical in that relationship, because while China seems to be frequently annoyed with and disappointed with and exerting pressure on the North Korean regime, particularly regarding its nuclear weapons program. On the other hand, China does not want to see North Korea consolidate or unify with the South into a single Korean nation, because that unified Korean peninsula would presumably be pro-Western, and China does not want to have a pro-Western state on its border. So in that sense, North Korea is a useful buffer state.
Well,
the other issue at stake there, though, is that China also does not want to see North Korea dissolve into chaos. Many of your listeners are probably aware that the North Korean government is either through deliberately or through incompetence starving the majority of their population, and with starvation comes disease. And so the idea of North Korea imploding has no attraction to the Chinese either. They do not want a massive humanitarian crisis on their border.
Good
with
point.
Presumably refugees flooding across into China. So for the time being, China seems to be satisfied with maintaining the status quo.
Okay. So as far back as I look, it was even World War One, Korea was involved, and it's there. And you know, you'd like to think of the other buffer countries being settled and settling into their own lives, but Korea is volatile still. And that all came to head in 1950. What day?
June 25th in Korea. It was June 24th back here in the United States. But yes, Bob, about 4 a.m. on the morning of June 25th in Korea, the North Koreans launched a massive armored assault across the 38th parallel. It was planned by Soviet military liaison officers, many of whom traveled with the initial formations across the border until Stalin directed that they be withdrawn. He didn't want any Soviet advisors captured with the North Korean forces. But the Soviets were heavily involved in planning that invasion and in training the North Koreans. The North Korean tanks were Soviet T-34 tanks, a very, very capable World War II tank. Not only that were they much better than anything the South Koreans had, but initially they were better than the American tanks that we had available in Japan.
Can I ask a quick question about that? I've never been able to really get the answer on the T-34. Did it have a revolving turret?
It did.
Ah, okay, okay. I've never really noticed it. I've looked and looked and looked. Okay, so here they come, caught the South Koreans, caught the Americans with their knickers down, and here they are. And I remember this, folks. I'm old enough to remember. It wasn't headlines. It was just a small article in the paper. Oh, a couple days later, it was June. I was a kid, you know, looking up current events and always had. And I saw that, and I remember this. I remember that starting. So here it is, and we were listening to Rosemary Clooney, Come Out of My House, and Milton Berle and Jackie Gleason and what, and all of a sudden things happen. How many troops, maybe not numbers, but what did we have on the ground on that 25th of June?
Maybe 450 troops, advisors with the South Korean government, or not the South Korean government, but the South Korean military. So we had a Korean military advisory group on the ground, and they were the initial source of information for MacArthur back in Tokyo and for the U.S. government back in Washington, D.C.
Did our government, and that includes MacArthur and Atchison, I know at one point Atchison thought, in fact, why don't you touch on this, why he said it was out of the sphere of influence? What do you think about that?
Well, it was out of our sphere of influence. The Joint Chiefs and MacArthur and the administration and Congress, both sides of the aisle, I might add, had generally agreed that the American military's ability to defend its interests around the world was limited. And MacArthur was well aware that South Korea was outside that area of interest. And so when Acheson made a speech at the National Press Club and described what he perceived as the American sphere of influence around the world, he did not include the Korean Peninsula.
Well, I guess...
So it was no surprise within the United States government. Really, it was no surprise to the Koreans either, although MacArthur had informed the South Korean leader that he would defend Korea as he would defend California.
Whoa.
Which he was not authorized to say. That
yes.
Was not U.S. policy. That rarely stopped General MacArthur from saying what he thought his audience wanted to hear.
Sounds like somebody else.
Well, and it was shortly before the U.S. military withdrew most of its combat forces from the Korean Peninsula. So I think maybe the lesson there was watch what we do, not what we say. And we did withdraw most of our U.S. forces in 1948 and 1949. We brought them back to Japan, where their primary mission was to defend the Japanese islands from a potential Soviet invasion.
Well, now, folks, we've got the North Koreans have come across the 38th parallel. They have stormed across, and they're smoking, and we're not able to get troops there for a couple of weeks. And I'm sure that there are some real horrifying tales from those troops that were there very early on. But a lot of our troops were captured in the beginning. A lot were captured and were made POWs. Isn't this called a segue? Yes, it is. So here we're going to segue with the man. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, right? Because we all know a little bit about Korea. So let's jump ahead. All right. We had the Korean War start. We're getting smoke down there. We had a little respite in Incheon, and we were able to get back to the 38th. But again, back at the frozen Chosin, it was American back on their heels, and they got captured, and they were POWs. You wrote the book, Cold Day in Hell, American POWs in Korea. Tell us about that.
So the United States and its allies, the British, had several thousand forces with us, as did the Australians, and the South Koreans had several divisions. This unified United Nations force pushed north of the 38th parallel against what was left of the North Korean army and captured the North Korean capital of Pyongyang in late October. Time magazine's cover story the next week detailed how the Korean War was won. This is late October. We thought everything was all just about wrapped up and that the remainder of the war would be simply a mopping up exercise as our troops pushed north to the Yalu to complete the occupation and reunification of the north of the Korean Peninsula. The Chinese, meanwhile, had given Truman and MacArthur several warnings, which both Truman and MacArthur ignored. And in late November, right after Thanksgiving Day, as U.S. and Korean forces were making the final push to the Yalu with the promise that they would be home by Christmas, the Chinese launched a massive counterattack on both sides of the peninsula. In the east, the Marines were encircled at the Chosin Reservoir. In the west, General Walker's 8th Army was pushed back more than 100 miles. UN forces had to abandon the North Korean capital of Pyongyang. And with that, they had to abandon millions of dollars in military supplies and ammunition and vehicles and whole trainloads of combat vehicles. It really was one of the worst American defeats of the 20th century. And U.S. forces withdrew all the way below the 38th parallel and were subsequently pushed back below Seoul. It was an incredible withdrawal and an incredible turn of events. As part of that counterattack, several American units and quite a few Korean units as well were encircled and approximately 3,000 Americans were captured in November and December of 1950, Father Emil Capon of the 8th Cavalry Regiment, 1st Cavalry Division, was one of those POWs captured. And I know Father Hotze will be on later to talk a little bit about Father Capon. By the way, Bob, this is the Friday was the 241st birthday of the U.S. Army Chaplains Corps.
Ah, yes, let's hear it for them. Say a little prayer. There we go.
They're here.
They're here. Well, now that we have introduced, why don't we just we've only got a minute before we got the news at the halfway mark. So, Father Hotze, hello.
Hello.
Hey, you're there all the way to Kansas.
Yes, I'm here.
Did you click your heels twice? Did you click your heels twice?
Oh, all the time.
All the time, yeah. Take me back.
No place like home. I'm perfectly happy here in Kansas.
I was stationed at Fort Riley. Okay, we'll be back with you in just a moment. Father, thank you for being patient. And right after the news, Bill, real quickly. Okay, so we've got Father Hotze will be coming on. We're talking about POWs 3,000. How much time we got? What, 30 seconds? Real quick. I should probably just, right, they're signaling me here. Bill, hang on, have a cup of coffee, whatever, tea, and we'll be back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. This is Bob Gould. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Yeah, there we go. Being a pilot, did you hear the news by any chance, Bill?
I did.
Yeah, well, being a pilot, I would say the problem was he was overweight.
I tell you what, those high tension lines have killed a lot of good people.
Yes, and in fact, we had that around Ann Arbor not too many years back. Yeah, I just think he had 16 people, and they were getting on, and I think that had something to do with it. And being a pilot, I'm sure you understand. In fact, most folks... is pilot error on aircraft, and it's from overloading. But we're not going to get into that. We're going to get into Korea. We're back to Korea, and we're back to the POWs. I'm talking with Lieutenant Colonel William Latham, who is a frequent contributor here on Veterans Radio. He wrote one of his books, and is Cold Days in Hell, The American POWs in Korea. It's available from Texas A&M University and from Amazon. Latham, L.A., T-H-A-M, William C., Jr., L-A-T-H-A-M, Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea. What was the most significant point that you made in that book?
I think the most significant point was that we misunderstand and misremember what happened to American POWs in Korea. There are still people who think they were brainwashed. And, in fact, what really happened was that the Chinese did make a concerted effort to convert American soldiers and Marines to communism. Most of our POWs were between the ages of 18 and 21, young enlisted guys just out of high school, if they finished high school. And if you've ever worked with a group of teenagers, you know how hard it is to keep their attention. The Chinese learn this the hard way. The Chinese would direct their POWs to have group discussions on the benefits of socialism and the workers' revolution, and then leave them to their own devices, at which point our guys generally would turn the topic to cars, food, girls, music, or anything but what their Chinese instructors wanted them to talk about.
Well, I have in my notes here, Manchurian candidate tie-in. So, were they not brainwashed, how should I say, what would be that term to where they became robots, like in the movie? Is that true?
Now, the movie is a fabrication. The original novel written by Richard Condon was a satire aimed at the overreaction of McCarthyism. However, it's worth noting that the director of the Hollywood movie starring Frank Sinatra, John Frankenheimer, thought that it was true, that it was a loosely fictional version of what had actually happened. And there were some Americans, a significant number of Americans in and out of government, who felt the same way, who thought that the communists had planted these sleeper cells and that they were waiting to strike the U.S. government as part of a massive communist attack on the West. By the way, the movie was pulled out of theaters a few weeks after it premiered because of the assassination of President Kennedy. Assassination, as you may recall, the notion of assassination plays a key role in the plot of the movie.
Yes, it does, absolutely. Anyway, folks, I'm not talking about the new version, folks. I'm talking about the one that was back in the 60s. It was
right. Well, it's a good topic, though, Bob, because unfortunately, too many Americans know about Korean POWs only through that movie and through some distorted versions of what really happened to our POWs in captivity.
And
yes, they were mistreated. Yes, the Chinese tried to convert them. Yes, a few Americans decided to stay behind, but in fact, the percentage of misconduct among American prisoners in Korea was no better or no worse than that in previous wars.
Well, can't think of the name of it now. I'll find it here, folks. I got it. Well, I'll postpone that until I find it. But their code of conduct. That's what happens when you get a little older. That was not in place. So here were American POWs sort of at loose. But being Americans, the POWs started to get informed. Well, there was a great part in the movie River Kwai about the distinction between being an enlisted man and an officer. And that was one of the things I know that they did with Korean POWs was to start to have some order and discipline. Tell us about that.
Well, the Korean and later the Chinese were slow to realize that the officers and non-commissioned officers exerted an important influence on the behavior of the enlisted prisoners, and it was only belatedly that the Chinese segregated the officers from the enlisted men, and then subsequently segregated the NCOs from the enlisted men. And their delay in doing that probably helped fortify the American prisoners against communist efforts to indoctrinate them or persuade them into misconduct. So, that was the standard tactic by the communists with our soldiers and Marines who were captured. They did segregate the officers from the NCOs, from the enlisted, and then they specifically targeted the junior enlisted soldiers who they saw as the youngest and most vulnerable and most prone to persuasion. And quite frankly, they did have a little bit of success, not so much in converting prisoners to communism, but rather in getting prisoners to turn against each other. There was some of that, but again, that sort of misconduct unfortunately happens in every war, within every group.
Yeah, it's more anecdotal, right?
Than it is.
Yes, okay, and it was institutional.
So the code of conduct established after the war was an effort to better prepare American service members and to better inform them of what the expectations were in future conflicts.
And also, folks, soldiers, sailors, Marines that are POWs, they're not going to get the best of chow, because not even the Chinese themselves or the North Koreans were getting chow or health care or what. So the Americans, allies, what the POWs were on their own. But that's when those times of stress and needs comfort, and when certain individuals rise above the fray, rise above the chaos, and we have some information on Father Emil Capon, who was a POW in Korea, and he died in Korea. But I'll tell you what, folks, let's get with our next guest, Father John Hotze. He's priest and judicial vicar for the Catholic Diocese of Wichita. And in 2003, Father Hotze was assigned to head a task force to promote the canonization of Father Emil Capon. Welcome to Veterans Radio, Father.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And thank you very much for your time on a beautiful Sunday. Okay, Father Capon, he's from Pilsen. Am I getting that right? Pilsen, Kansas?
Pilsen, Kansas.
Pilsen, Kansas. Well, go ahead. Tell us about what made that person so special.
Before I do that, can I go on and wish good luck to all of the POWs, the Korean War POWs? They're just finishing up a reunion that they had in St. Louis, so they'll be traveling home today, so we wish them all safe travels and best of luck to them, and certainly thank them for their service. Father Capon was one that tried to do whatever he could to keep from what you were talking about happening. I mean, the some animosity around the POWs and things like that. And he was there in the prisoner of war camp, prison camp number 5, when they separated the prisoners, when they had the enlisted men were further down the mountain, and the officers were in the part of the camp that was further up the mountain. And I find it interesting, one of the Dr. Sidney Essenson told me a story, and he said that there, of course, most of the people that died in the POW camp died because of the weather. I mean, because it was so cold, and they didn't have winter uniforms. Most of them lost their shoes when they were captured, lost them because the North Koreans and Chinese took their boots, because their boots were, or the boots of the American soldiers were so much better than what their own were, so they would steal them for themselves. So most of them had frostbite rather quickly, because all they had was whatever they could find to wrap around their feet. But once they got into the camp and they were segregated, Father Capon knew that was going to be a problem, and he knew that they needed to do whatever they could to make sure that the enlisted men knew that they were still present, that the officers were still there present. Dr. Essenson said that every night, he said, Father Capon would gather them together, and they would all have to go out and stand out there and outside of their huts. And he said they would sing. And he said that they would sing so that the enlisted men would know that they were still there. He said they would sing America the Beautiful. He said they would sing God Save the Queen, because there are so many British soldiers there. They would sing the Star Spangled Banner, and he said they would always end up with the Lord's Prayer. So he said that was one of the ways that Father Capon was able to let the enlisted men know that the officers were still there with them, even though they were segregated.
And what was so, folks, this man, Father Capon, he had everything that he, how should I, I'm looking for the word that he was able to, it wasn't just Catholics, he was able to connect with the Jewish soldier or POWs, with the atheists, etc. He was able, in fact, there was one story about a Jewish POW during Christmas time made a cross for Father Capon. Actually, he was a carpenter. Oh, familiar? Tell us about that.
Yeah. Actually, it happened after Father Capon had passed away there in the POW camp. From what I understand, Colonel Fink was able to carve things, and that he was carving a stethoscope for some of the doctors to use. So some of the other POWs approached him and asked if they would carve a crucifix, or if he would carve a crucifix in memory of Father Capon. So he started to work on this crucifix, and it became known as the Christ in Barbed Wire, because he was able to carve this crucifix. And what he used was a metal shank that he had taken out of a boot, and he had sharpened it up so that he could carve this crucifix. They said that he was caught a couple of times carving this crucifix, and that when they caught him, that he told them that he was carving a likeness of Abraham Lincoln. Because for some reason, the North Koreans would accept him carving Abraham Lincoln. Well, if they had found out that it was Father Chapin, they would have put an abrupt halt to it.
Oh, sure. What, Bill, what do you think, what makes men like Father Capon? In your opinion, you wrote the book. What are some of the base characteristics?
Well, I would describe Emil Capon as what they call country strong. He was not a especially sophisticated person, but he was strong and durable. He had grown up on a farm, a very simple farm, no running water. He had been an altar boy in the church in Pilsen. He had gone to seminary in high school. He had a very strong faith in God and a calling to become a priest. And during World War II, he volunteered several times to become a military chaplain because he felt a calling to minister to the military. And he finally wore down... correct me if I'm wrong, Father John. He finally wore down the archbishop who gave him permission to become a military chaplain, and he deployed in World War II and served in the in India and later Burma with the American Army in that theater. And so he was a World War II veteran when he reentered the chaplaincy in 1949 and deployed to Japan and subsequently with the 1st Cavalry Division. Korea, where he was captured. But he was a legend among the men before he was captured. And he continued his fearless performance of his duties after his capture. And really, I'll let Father John tell some of those stories. He's more familiar with them than I am. I would mention, though, that Emil Capon is not only a recipient of the Medal of Honor, but is also under consideration for canonization by the Catholic Church.
Oh, we call that a segue, folks. He's reading my notes. How can you do that, Bill, all the way from Virginia? You must have eyes all over. Yes. Why don't you touch on that, Father John?
Okay. He was awarded the Medal of Honor back in 2013. We've been working on his cause for canonization for some time now. We finished it on our diocesan level back in 2011, and at that time we sent over 8,000 pages of documents to the Congregation for Saints in Rome. So there has been some activity over in Rome about him being named a saint. From those 8,000 pages of documents, they have written what is called the Positio, which is the official story of Father Capon's life. And Bishop Kimmy of Wichita was able to present that to the Congregation for Saints back in November of 2015. So that's when they were first able to start to investigate his life from the official documents that they had then. And actually, just about a month or so ago, we were informed by the Congregation for Saints that he has passed the first step, and that was being approved by their historical committee. So the historical committee reviewed the positio and found everything that was in order, found that everything was in order for him to be going on or to be advanced to the next stage. So now the theological commission will look at his life, look at everything that he wrote, look at everything that was written about him to make sure that everything that he did was doctrinally sound, that was in conformity with the teachings of the Catholic Church. So that will be going on now, and we hope that that will be completed soon, and then he'll go on to the next stage for the canonization process, and that would be with the approval of an alleged miracle done for his intercession. I know a lot of people don't understand that. Basically, what it is we, as Catholics and Christians, believe that when we die here on this earth, that our life isn't over, and that those that have died and gone before us and pray for us, just as we pray for people that are here on earth now, pray for our family members and pray for others that we know and love, And so that we ask the saints to pray for us, or those the people that we believe to be saints to pray for us.
Father John, is there a Facebook page anything?
We have both Facebook page and a web page. It's Father Capon, FatherKapaun.org.
And
all of that information on those.
Give that again.
It's FatherCapon.org, FatherKapaun.org.
Yeah, and would you email me that information, would you please, Father John, so I can put that on our website?
I certainly will. Yep.
Yeah, right. Well, we're going to say goodbye now to the POW situation and there in Korea. Father John, would you please come back with us again when there's a further update, right? Right.
I'd be glad to. Yes, I would.
We're going to be staying on top of this story. You have a great day.
Thanks. You do the same.
Thank you. Okay. Bill, we've only got, what do we got, 8 minutes, 10 minutes? Here we go. And we got MacArthur. He's got the A-bomb in his back pocket. He's got to be doing backflips. How could he ever contain himself by not using nuclear weapons? Tell us about that.
Well, he never actually proposed dropping atomic bombs on China. I think he would have been happy to. There were some reasons why we couldn't do that. We just didn't have the ability to deliver them in the first place, and there's real question whether that would have done any good in the second place. He did, however, propose laying a belt of nuclear waste across the China-North Korea border to prevent more Chinese from reinforcing their allies down in the Korean Peninsula. Had MacArthur been able to carry out that plan, the environmental devastation is incalculable. But
he's nuts. That was nuts. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, folks. That was how would you ever get it there?
I'm reluctant to rush to judgment.
Okay. 60 years later, you still are, right?
All right. Oh, I did give him a zero when we talked about it.
I know. And out of our three historians, two gave him zeros. But that was nuts. That was absolutely nuts. And I remember how the American people, they didn't say that. They went, can we do that? Oh, man, sounds like the thing to do. Oh, wow. Tell us about that, the American reaction to all that garbage.
The war in Korea went from being an overwhelmingly popular move in July of 1950 to being an overwhelmingly unpopular action in August of 1950 to being an overwhelmingly popular move in October, and back and forth like a pinata over the next few months, depending on how U.S. and Korean forces were faring on the battlefield. And by December of 1950, not only did the American public tired of the war, but MacArthur himself was worried that the Chinese counterattack might force him to evacuate all U.N. forces from the Korean Peninsula. And this may have been a ploy to try to persuade the Pentagon to send more divisions to Korea. Rather than fall for that, the Joint Chiefs told MacArthur, "You're in charge. You do what you think is best."
Whoa. And did he?
He calmed down after a while. The battle line stabilized below Seoul towards the end of the year, and the Chinese outran their supplies. Also, General Walker, who had performed very well during the initial months of the war and then not so well in October and November, died in a car crash, and he was replaced by General Matthew Ridgway.
Oh, give him a rate. Rate him. Rate him.
Oh, he's a 10.
Whoa. Why?
He's a 10. Ridgway not only was able to sort of handle MacArthur and keep MacArthur from over-controlling his efforts on the Korean Peninsula, but Ridgway subsequently replaced MacArthur as the commander of UN forces when Truman fired MacArthur in April of 1951.
Why did Truman do that?
MacArthur was, what is the legal term? Insubordinate. MacArthur was insubordinate and openly criticized the administration. Moreover, at a point where the State Department was trying to establish back-channel communications with the Chinese to begin ceasefire negotiations in March of 1951, MacArthur submarined those efforts by going on the radio and demanding the immediate surrender of all communist forces.
I remember that. I remember that. My mother listened to that.
And finally, although it is not widely reported, MacArthur's staff had made back-channel communications to the Spanish government of General Franco, assuring them that he would find a way to get the United States involved in a war on mainland China.
Well, let's fast forward to what we've got today. We've only got 3 minutes to go before the end of the program, and I know it's a big question, and you can't answer it in 3 minutes, but give us what you can on where do we go with North Korea. It's a proxy of China, right? I mean, how did they get nuclear weapons? They didn't get them from the Russians, I'm sure, and they certainly didn't get it from Toledo, Ohio. So,
well, remember, the North Koreans have been dealing with bad actors around the world for the last 60 years, and I am not an expert on this. I would speculate, though, that the Pakistani scientists who developed Pakistan's nuclear arsenal and were later accused of espionage are, I would say, the most likely culprits for selling nuclear secrets to the Koreans. I would not call Korea a Chinese proxy. Rather, Korea is sort of a dangerous little rat in a corner, and we need to be very careful in how we deal with them, because while they may not pose an immediate threat to the United States, we have a lot of friends in Korea and Japan, and we have 28,000 troops on the ground over there. We really, nobody would win a second Korean War.
All right, we've got 2.5 minutes to go, and I want your there she goes, she's shaking her head, Nina is. Okay, you've got 2 minutes. Tell me, Bill, you're the president. What would you do?
Well, I would continue to try to engage the North Korean government in six-party talks with the other key players in the region, and I would try to reduce tensions and draw them into the larger world community. And at the same time, I think that the more the Korean government and the Korean people, the North Korean government and the North Korean people, are exposed to civilization, the more they will move in our direction.
Well, I
honestly think that's inevitable. There are people sneaking cell phones into Korea.
Yeah.
There are people sneaking books into Korea. The Koreans themselves are still sending their people to work camps for these types of crimes. But Koreans are knocking down the doors trying to escape from that country. And I just don't think that can last for the next 30 years. Something's going to happen. It's in the world's interest to ensure that whatever happens on Korea, Korean Peninsula, happens peacefully.
I got one quick question. We got less than a minute, and it's just a yes or no. And when we're looking at Korea, if we were to assassinate Kim Jong-un, that there would be a mass influx, hundreds of thousands going from the north to the south. We can't handle that kind of influence because they want to escape. Is that true, yes or no?
I don't think a decapitation would work. The next four-star general in line would simply take over and assume command, and we really have no way of telling whether the next guy will be even nuttier or less nutty than the guy who's in charge right now.
I think we'll end on that. We've got 20 seconds to go. Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much for being on the program. Of course, we're going to have you back again in September sometime. We'll be talking some more. And you have a great day, okay, Bill?
Thank you, Bob. You too. Thanks for having me on.
And we want to thank all of you that are listeners. Next week, Veterans Radio. Until then, you are dismissed.